Okay.
Thank you
for coming out. Thank you. Martinelli's for everybody.
Yes.
My name's Greg. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Greg.
Good afternoon. There's a guy named Mike French who passed about 20 years ago in sobriety. And every time he got up to share, he would start with the third step prayer. And it would go like this: God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I might better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them might bear witness to those I would help of thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And he was one of two cops in the city of Brentwood when that was all Brentwood had. And he would wear Daisy Duke shorts just because he could, which was an odd look. So I was born at an early age, and I was born in a succession of alcoholics through the male side as well as through my mom's side. My dad was, in the beginning, a very successful executive with Hartford Insurance. And over time, he became less successful. And with every successive mishap, he would be demoted. So he started off as an executive VP, then he was a VP, then he was a senior director, then he was a director, then he was a field manager. And by the time we were done, he was a field manager, and we had moved four or five times and left Massachusetts, came out to California, left San Ramon to go Walnut Creek because San Ramon was so rural. You know, coming from a long line of alcoholics is absolutely not what made me an alcoholic. Having a dad that had been a hero that sort of stepped on it and became less successful was not what made me an alcoholic. Going to new schools and being the new kid, not what made me an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic because I loved the effect that alcohol produced in me. I went to a fundraiser last night, and we were talking about it at our table. It was a Moa Moa foundation. And at that table, there were a slew of wrestlers. And when I went to high school, there was a guy named Lee Blakeney who was an All-American and a big kid as a freshman. I was 5'4 and 106 pounds. He was 6'1 and 215 pounds. I remember Lee hit me, and I did the If Man Could Fly. And I remember landing thinking, freshman football isn't necessarily what I want to do when I grow up. I think I would be a great cross-country athlete. And that's not what made me an alcoholic. You know, being the new kid, being shy, being uncomfortable, that just wasn't it. I did leave football, and I did become a track athlete, and I lettered as a freshman. And one of the things that happened for me as a freshman was I started hanging out with seniors. And they had beards, much like Peter had, which for me was long into the horizon. No beard here. I was on this side of puberty, still looking forward to it. But I was really quick and did pretty well as a freshman. And so I'm hanging out with seniors, and at one point, they said, Greg, let's go to the Solano Drive-In. And this is 1977, and the original Star Wars came out. And that was followed by a classic Kentucky Fried movie, which some of you may remember. And we had those 44-ounce Cokes. You pour half of it out, and you fill it up with Southern Comfort. And that was my first drunk. And I intuitively knew how to go bulimic so I could drink more. And I did. And I got sick, and I remember out of kindness, My posse dropped me off about a half mile from my parents' home. And again, I grew up on the tough streets of Walnut Creek, so, you know, you don't have to worry about me getting home. I did. But I got to my stairs of the house going up, and my dog started barking because he was excited to see me. And I'm holding up the wall because I don't want the wall to come down as I'm going up the stairs. And I'm just lit. And my dad grabs me, cleans me off, takes me upstairs, puts me to bed. And I remember the bed spinning. And I thought, this is weird. The bed wasn't spinning before. So I put my foot down to hold the bed in place so it wouldn't spin anymore. And that didn't work either. So again, I was ill there, threw up. And it was messy. And I remember waking up thinking, this was really fun. I want to do this again. And so one of the things that happened is occasionally this posse of mine would forget to pick me up. And I'd sit in the living room and look out the window like that puppy that was barking when I got home and just look and wonder where my friends were that were going to pick me up to take me out to go cruise Main Street or go up to behind Northgate and, you know, hang out. And I just remember feeling really alone, really rejected, really insecure about why, you know, they said they were going to pick me up and then they didn't. And that happened a couple of times. And then the next time they'd pick me up and all was forgiven. But it made me really self-conscious and really insecure. And I was already, again, I said massive at 5'4 and 106 pounds. So I wasn't deluded with feelings of grandeur yet. Drinking helped with that, though. My drinking in high school and in college represented this kind of pendulum swinging. And what I mean by that is when I got really competitive with track, I would stop drinking. And I was also a gymnast, and so when I got really competitive with meets, I would stop. But the rest of the time, if there was a party, I was there. And that was kind of the way I went through high school. I went to UC Davis, and we talked about viticulture and enology a little bit. My introduction to Davis was, I literally did not visit the campus. My dad dropped me off at the dorms at Tercero, and they're right by the animal farms at the south end of the campus, south west end. And they're on a quarter system, so school starts in late September. I remember getting out of the car and getting hit with this heat bomb. You know, it's like 105 degrees, and it just smells like pig manure. And I'm thinking, this is my life. This is what I signed up for. And so for that freshman year, the predominant smell that I remember is cow dung and pig manure. And it was horrific. My first date was with a woman that invited me to go see Debbie Does Dallas. And that was then followed by a party at the SAE house, a fraternity right there on 5th Street, 5th and Russell. You would think that if a woman invites you to go see a porno, it's a sure thing. Let me say that when you throw up on her as you're trying to make it to the bushes at a toga party at SAE, that sure thing becomes less certain. Dramatically less certain. I was not a tremendous college student. I was a pretty good student in high school, you know, honors classes and recognized for that. When I got to Davis, I found that going to 8 o'clock classes was really hard, like impossible. 9 o'clock classes weren't really that much better. And 10 o'clock I could sometimes make. it's a quarter system, so you got 9 weeks of school, and then your 10th week is a final. It's pretty quick. You miss a couple of weeks of school, you're not going to prosper. So after 3 years of school, actually almost three years of school, my father came up to Davis to visit. And Dad looked at me and he said, "Gregory." And anytime you hear your full name, you know you're in deep kimchi. And so, "Gregory, two things are going on here. You're wasting your time and my money. And at least one of those is going to stop. Why don't you try the Army? It might make a man out of you." So I go with him and I start talking to recruiters. And I talk to the Air Force, and the Air Force has their program up at Sac State, and that's 20 miles that way. And I didn't have a car, so that was tough. Navy and Marine Corps was down at UC Berkeley, down Cal, down Highway 80. That was almost an hour. Still didn't have a car, so that was out of the question. And I talked to a recruiter for the Army, and they're right there at Davis. And he says, "Gregory," again, I'm in trouble because of the whole name, "you're going to be guaranteed Army aviation. You're going to love this." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm going to fly helicopters. This is going to be great." And he says, "When you go to basic training, bring your golf clubs and your tennis racket." It's like, really? Okay. So school ends, and late June hits, and I take my golf clubs and my tennis racket and my, do you remember Izod? My Izod jersey and my Madras shorts and my collar flipped up like this. And I land at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And Staff Sergeant Rodrigo Torres meets me with the bus. He says something that I can't repeat here, but he says, "You're mine." And for the next 4 days, I had a parade field that was about 60 yards wide, and I was able to carry two rocks. And I could carry the pile of rocks that was here over to there. And for 4 days, I carried rocks back and forth for 10 hours a day. True story. At the end of that, I borrowed his van. Literally, at the end of basic training, the last week we had Liberty, had a pass. I borrowed his truck and went golfing. We do recover. Basic training was not what I expected. The Izod shirt and the Madras shorts were put away. And I wore an OG 507 uniform, and I sweat profusely. And when we got out, I drank profusely. I learned how to take dog tags and take the chain through the nostril and floss down like that. You have to be pretty inebriated to do that. But I did it. Graduated, and at the end of camp, I got a notice from my platoon sergeant indicating that I had been selected for a full-ride scholarship. And I was at the Ambassador's Club at Louisville, Kentucky, and I called my dad, collect. And I said, "Dad, General Isaac D. Smith commanding has offered me a full-ride scholarship. What do you think?" And my dad said, "Gregory," once again, full name, "Gregory, I think you should take the scholarship. If you do, we'll continue to support you. If you don't, you're on your own. I'll pick you up at 4. And he hung up. I took the scholarship. My senior year at Davis was actually, my junior year, my fourth year, was more of the same. I became a founding father of a chapter of Sigma Chi, the Theta Omicron chapter at Sigma Chi, and was pretty active there. For six quarters, I was the little sister rush chairman because somebody had to run that program, and you know, I was willing to step up and do that kind of work. So unsurprisingly, I did not take ROTC that seriously. It interrupted with my drinking and my drugging. There were eight little bivouacs over the weekend once a month, and I missed six of them the first year. Not supposed to do that. Next summer, I go to advanced camp up at Fort Lewis, and coldest I've ever been was a summer at Fort Lewis. There was an ice storm that came in off of Mount Olympia, and we're out there, and all we have are our OG-507s and a poncho, and it's ice and sleet and cold, and we've been up for 2 or 3 days. Guys were walking into fire ant mounds, and a couple of those guys got really sick and were recycled, and one ended up leaving. But I drank my way through that. At the end of the second quarter, I got my detail indicating that I was, in fact, not going to be an aviation officer. I was going to be an artillery officer. So I graduate from Davis. I go to basic training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And if you want to know why Texas has not fallen into the Gulf of America, it's primarily because Oklahoma sucks. It is not a garden spot. Lawton, Oklahoma consisted of strip clubs and massage parlors. It was pretty seedy, but that's where I did my officer's basic course. I ended up getting selected to do a slew of follow-on courses that got me into special weapons, and I ended up going to language school, which some of us have gone to at the Presidio of Monterey. My job got in the way of my golf. My job got in the way of my drinking. And, you know, I was pretty much a hedonist. If it caused me pain, I'd avoid it. And if it caused me pleasure, I sought it. And that was how I was going through life. And at 22, 23 years old, I hit the Presidio of Monterey, which, I mean, if you spend any time down there, it's really close to paradise. If you took the San Diego climate and you moved it to Monterey, it would be paradise. That's what the Garden of Eden looks like, I think. But I drank my way through that and ended up as a young officer moving to Holland. And I was in the Netherlands for 3 years and had a field day. My first officer's hail and farewell, which is a little bit like force fun, where they make you interact with other officers from within the group, which in special weapons is like a battalion. We all got together, and this was at a German officer's concern, Kaserne, and they had boats. It was on a lake, and I had a friend challenge me to drink a 12-ounce glass of gin. Could you shoot this? It's like, well, yes, I can. So I knock it back. He says, I'll bet you $10 you can't do that again. So he went to the bar, came back within a couple of minutes, and I shoot the second 12-ounce glass of gin. He says, I know you can't do that again. I'll bet you $100 you can't do that. And so I take 36 ounces of gin in about 10 minutes, and I proceed to black out. And during this blackout, what has been told to me is I organized a mutiny, and we got on the boats that the German officers had at this marina, and I taught them how to play bumper pool with other people's boats. Not supposed to do that, evidently. We were brought back to the dock or to the marina, and somehow I decided it would be a good idea to kiss the colonel's wife. And the colonel is the battalion commander, the group commander. Bert Vanderklut, airborne, had been, you know, Vietnam vet, hard-ass, tough guy. And I kiss his wife. Also not supposed to do that. At some point in time, I decide I need to use the bathroom. And so I go to the bathroom because that's what I do. And I'm sitting on the toilet and I'm still wearing, you know, my dress uniform, dress greens, but I've got cotton plaid shorts, polo shorts, and I'm on the latrine like this, and I've got a thumb in my eye like this, and I'm passed out, and Colonel Vanderklut takes one of those video cameras that in 1987 were about the size of North Dakota and takes the 52 officers and wives of the group and brings them in to introduce me to them in all my glory. My wife, by the way, I forgot to tell you that I took a hostage in 1987 and married. She was mortified. And I had no idea why, because I was in a blackout. I had no idea that any of this had happened. But it happened. I spent the next 2.5 years doing penance for what I did to Colonel Vanderklut's wife and what I did with the boats. And kind of was the story of my military career. I would do really good things, and then I'd do something stupid. And I would spend 4, 6, 8 months doing something really good, and then I'd do something stupid. And I did a lot of that. My drinking followed the path that Father Tom talks about. In the beginning, it's fun. And over time, it becomes fun with problems. And at the end, it's nothing but problems. The 80s, it was still fun, but problems were beginning to occur. My wife, after that boating, kissing the colonel's wife, thinker pose incident, approached me and said, "Gregory," again, full name, "I think you may have a problem with alcohol. I think you need AA." Now, I had no idea what AA was. So I looked at her and I said, "I am not going to do Amway." Because I couldn't tell her that I didn't know what AA was. But I figured if I used words and just filled space, it might make the conversation that was pretty uncomfortable go away. It didn't go away. So I talked to the battalion XO, and he indicated that because it was a one-off, that I was not a good candidate for rehab and that I should just moderate my drinking. So that's how that went. Left Holland, and I should probably say I had the opportunity to get trained by one of the best NCOs, non-commissioned officers, that the Army's ever produced. Sergeant Gary Bess. Ended up becoming Command Sergeant Major Gary Bess. But he took me under his wing, and, you know, I'm a first lieutenant by now, and I had a platoon. And we started doing things like Dutch special weapons training. We did the jump school. We did Nijmegen Road March. We did TAC Ops training down at Permasans at the brigade headquarters. And everybody in my platoon was getting promoted faster because we had them, not we, Sergeant Best said, "You know what, we should do correspondence courses because that gives these kids points. And the more points they have, the more promotable they are." And so things started looking really good. And unfortunately, about 3 years ago, I went back to Fort Sill and I buried Sergeant Bess, Command Sergeant Major Gary Bess. This disease is fatal. you play with this thing, and things like kidney failure and organ failure, and your liver goes out, and people that you really care about, they can die. And I had a relationship with Sergeant Best that carried on, you know, that this was 1988, 89, and I was talking to him in 2022. You know, we had a relationship that went all that time, and he was that special a guy to me. So I leave the Netherlands, and I go to my officer's advanced course back at Fort Sill. By this time, we have a young child, and I'm taking life a little bit more seriously now because I have a young one, and my wife and I are, you know, living in this dump of an apartment in Lawton, Oklahoma. Make captain, get sent down to Fort Hood, and at Fort Hood, didn't get there, and but maybe 3 or 4 weeks later, the Iraqis invade Kuwait. And pretty quickly, President Bush sent the 82nd Airborne there, sent the 173rd Special Weapons Group, and about 2 months later, 1st Cav shows up. And so I deploy to Iraq. Actually, I'm in Saudi Arabia for most of the time, but I'm in Saudi, and I'm introduced to sobriety because Saudi Arabia is a dry location. And I don't drink for about eight and a half months. I could have gestated. but I don't drink. And there were guys that had their wives or their friends send them Listerine that looked suspiciously like bourbon. And, you know, I wasn't one of those guys. Feel a lot like Forrest Gump sometimes. I mean, I was in Berlin when the wall came down. I got a Bronze Star for firing the first Copperhead, which is a guided munition, in anger. And, you know, I was just there. Just happened to be the guy that, that did that the first time. I come back and I'm selected to be an aide-de-camp to a two-star, a major general. And I do that job for quite a while, for 13 months. And if you want a really good education on how successful people operate, go work for a CEO or go work for a two-star general. Everything that went into his office, I saw before it got to him. And everything that went out of his office, I saw before I took it to the colonels that needed action, what he said to do. And it was an amazing experience. Didn't drink a lot there either, just because I was pretty busy. But I became, and I'd already been a hard drinker, but I became a binge drinker during this period. And when I was off, I would binge drink. You know, nothing to drink, a handle and a case of beer like that. And during this time, this is like 91, 92, there was a flash message that General Page got that said, hey, captains of this year group are being offered $40,000 to leave. And General Page tells me that, you know what, Greg? The only reason I stayed in is because I have a daughter that needed care at Walter Reed. This guy was a two-star, and he's telling me that if he had it to do all over again, he might have thought about getting out. And he said, you're going to be successful wherever you go. I'm not sure that, you know, here's what's going to happen. You're going to get a second command. I already had command as a lieutenant. You're going to get another command because you work for me. You don't screw that up, you're going to be a staff officer. You'll probably get picked up for major below the zone because you work for me. And if you don't screw up major, you're going to make lieutenant colonel. If you don't screw that up, you're going to get a battalion command. And he said 90% of all general officers were aide-de-camps. So you stay in the military, you got a pretty good shot of not screwing it up and having a pretty good career. But again, the only reason I stayed in, this is a two-star looking at me, and I'm doing his boots watching Monday Night Football. The only reason I stayed in is because Gail needed care at Walter Reed. So I made a decision to separate, and part of that was influenced because my wife, when we had been dating before I took her hostage, I promised her that I would help her get her PhD. And so my wife's a clinical psychologist. She's had a private practice now for almost 30 years. And I helped her do that. I left the service in 92. Learned how to drink on what's called other people's money. In enterprise or commercial business, they call that an expense account. And I lost the entire decade of the 90s. From 92 on, it's a blur. I know I had a daughter because she was born in March of 92. I know I went up the corporate ladder, both in clinical lab and then in telecommunications. And I know my wife got her doctorate. But the whole decade is a blur. I tried to quit drinking starting probably by 94 every day. And by noon, I was taking a doctor out and having drinks, or at my dealer getting something in a powdered form of alcohol to help me operate faster. I had no problem quitting at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning. But by noon, I was already unquit. I couldn't stay quit. And that was my problem for an awfully long time. I had no idea how to stop for good. And that whole decade is gone to me, which is really disappointing. My last drunk was centered around a golf tournament, and then a friend had a party. And so this was a scramble, and my team won. The four of us each got $150 to spend in the pro shop or the bar. We drank $600 within an hour, which seems like a lot of booze. I then got in my car. I stopped at a 7-Eleven, picked up a 12-pack, and I drank half of that from the golf course right by the airport in Sacramento, and I got to Folsom. And about this time in Folsom, I black out again. And evidently, I was doing karaoke in my bathing suit, my au naturel bathing suit. And at some point, the host of the party calls my wife, and we were living in Antioch, and the drive from Antioch to Folsom is, it's a healthy hike. It's about 90 minutes. And my wife, Claire, brings our two children up, Ryan and Lauren. They're this time 11, almost 12, and 9. And I come to with my kids looking at me with disgust. Embarrassment, shame, and I didn't really mention this. My dad, the way he drank, was he would stay buttoned down. You know, he just was very together until about 9 o'clock, and then the kids would go to bed and he would start drinking. And so from 9 to 11 or 9 to 12, he would hammer. And that was sort of my motif, unless I was drinking with physicians or later on, you know, my clients as a telecommunications guy. So my kids, they looked at me like I was their hero up until this night in Folsom, where they saw me in my bathing suit doing karaoke, and they just were mortified. And I did what any good self-respecting alcoholic would do. I blame my wife for exposing them to this type of behavior because it was never my fault until it was. And that next morning, I had a conversation with Claire that was painful. And I looked back on the last, you know, I'm 38 years old, so the last 23 years of my life, and I've squandered opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. And I'm just thinking, what the heck am I doing? And for the first time in a long time, I humbled myself and I asked for help. And we went to church, and I had just this raging hangover. And going to church where they're singing and their lights, and it's just, ugh, I was dying. But I talked to the usher, and I said, Wes, I need help. And he said, I'm not the guy, but I know a guy. And he introduces me to a guy named Harry Powell. And Harry Powell was a grandfatherly gentleman who'd been sober at this point probably 31 years. And he said, Greg, we're going to have breakfast Monday morning, tomorrow morning, at the Matchmaker in Pittsburgh. And I'll see if I can't help you. And so I don't drink all of Sunday. This is at least a 2-day hangover. I'm still miserable. I go to the Matchmaker, and he asks me a couple of questions over, you know, bacon and eggs. He's like, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Are you done? Are you willing to go to any length to get sober? And I knew the right answer was yes. And so I lied. I said, yeah, I'm willing to do anything. This is horrible. And so Harry works with me. And instead of telling me about AA, for the next 4 years, he showed me AA. He took me to the Pittsburgh detox. He took me to meetings. And 6 or 7 days a week, I followed that man to meetings. And before I knew it, he was saying, well, he'd be a really good coffee maker. You know what? You can do literature. Oh, by the way, you can do newcomer greeter. And, you know, when we finished the steps, he's like, you would be a really good secretary. And it's time for you to be a treasurer. And so I didn't volunteer for jobs in AA, trusted servant positions. At least for the first 4 years, I didn't volunteer for squat. I was directed that you're going to go be this. But Harry loved me and introduced me to a community that loved me until I could learn how to love myself. And when we went through the steps, a lot was revealed about who I was and baggage that I'd been carrying and why, you know, why I drank and what I was trying to avoid. And when I got to this program, my emotions were hungry, horny, and angry. And about 6 months into it, my wife got me a shirt, and it had the I am, and it had about 30 faces. And it's like, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm ecstatic, I'm overjoyed. And it had all of these faces, just cartoon faces. And with Harry's help, I began to learn what some of those emotions were and how to feel emotion other than hungry, horny, and angry. And it went that way for a long time. Harry passed in sobriety. And I got introduced to a guy named Effing Daryl. And Effing Daryl used the F word like it was poetry. And I worked with Daryl for 12 years. The only thing we had in common was sobriety. He was a NASCAR hard ass. And, you know, I was rising up in the field of SBC and then AT&T. But the guy helped me stay sober, and he helped me get into service, and he taught me how to sponsor other men. And then Daryl passed. And I started working with the guy that I have now. And so I've been working with Lance for the last 7 years. There was a track meet yesterday, BVAL at Foothill High School. And there were some amazing athletes. And they did something, you know, that they do at every track meet. They have relay races. And with a relay race, you got four men or women that each run either 100 meters or they run a full 400 meter, and then they take the stick and they hand it to the next person. And then that goes on with three more handoffs or three handoffs total until all four have passed through the loop. And I kind of want to just read something that has meant a lot to me and then kind of relay it back to this track meet that took place yesterday at with De La Salle just crushing it. It says this: highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, even psychologist wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor or the priest or the pastor. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. We're in a relay race. And there are people that I am never going to be able to sponsor. But men that I have sponsored are uniquely qualified to sponsor those people. And it's just a race. And what we have are a few sufficient facts that enable us to gain the confidence of another alcoholic. And that confidence is enough to help people occasionally turn the corner and get sober and stay sober. And because they've got a different personality skill set than I have and a different background, they're able to reach somebody that I would never reach. And that's like the guy with the first leg. He's not going to hand the baton off to the guy in the third leg. He's going to hand it off to the guy in the second leg. And it's amazing to me. I shared this story up at a meeting in Vacaville, and a woman relayed this to something that she had just read that day, and it was like random factoids that you get on Google or Alexa or whatever. And she said the ancient Greek competition is the Lampadodromia. And what that was a marathon where it didn't matter if you came in first. It mattered that you had the torch lit and you could run it individually or you could run it as a relay. And that race with that torch is you and I carrying the message to the next alcoholic who suffers. There is a solution. We do recover. And it doesn't matter if you get to the finish line first. What matters is you get to the finish line and your torch is still lit. And it's interesting. I find little factoids in the 12 and 12 and in the big book that I swear weren't there before. And it's like, because I've read these books a number of times. And this is in the foreword to the 12 by 12. I mean, what is the message that we carry? What's the message? It's really simple. It says this: AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. We do recover. And there's somebody that Dave is going to be able to reach that I could never reach. And there are people that I can reach that Robert would never reach. And it's like each of us have a part to play. And that part is unique. And the message is simple. It doesn't change. The message is we do recover. And so with this relay race, I'm finding that for me, the best thing I can do today in recovery is go to the Genesis House the first two Saturdays of every month. And I can go see people that need to hear the message of recovery. And I can bring in speakers that are impacting people's lives. You know, I brought a young woman in, and there were three women that flocked to her at the end of the meeting. And when we were done, this person came to me and she said, how do we do something that helps them when they finish? When they're done with the Genesis House and they've done it for 3 months or 90 days or whatever, 6 months, how do we help them on the next day? And the battle is in detox. The battle is in rehab. The battle is with people with young sobriety. And when we have a message to carry and we share that message, that baton is passed to the next person. Guys, I probably talked long enough because I think you said 45 minutes. Jack, I want to thank you for inviting me to share, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you.